Good morning, friends in Christ and Redeemer family. This week we'll be going over the Civil War and kind of that time period and how it affected American Presbyterianism. So, as you pull up your slides, I am on slide 11, which is our intro to this week's lesson. So, in the introduction slide, we have kind of two pictures going on there. On your left would be the person of Charles Finney. Now, I've shared this picture before because I personally find it to be extremely terrifying. He is actually the person that invented the altar call and the sinner's box. And I always, when I look at that picture, I see his eyes and I think to myself, if I saw those eyes and I was summoned to trust in Christ and come before to pray a prayer, I probably would as well. He's somebody that is not looked kind upon in the Presbyterian tradition. He is also, I think, for a time, the president of Oberlin College in Ohio, which, if I remember correct and serves my memory well, that is a Methodist, or was originally had ties to Methodism, and actually was a strong hotbed of abolitionism as well. Some interesting things about Finney is he did, in fact, deny the substitutionary atonement of Christ. He had a more moral. There's one perspective that's called the moralistic argument, which basically says Jesus was a good moral character person, and what we have to imitate is his sacrifice on the cross. Which I'm sure for many of us who've come out of the mainline, who have perhaps had one pastor or heard a sermon that was very similar to something that Finney would have preached. I know. Growing up going to a Methodist church, that was pretty similar to the message that I heard. And then on your right, we have Abe Lincoln photographed with a bunch of soldiers, and he's somebody who is obviously a very important figure during that time period. Somebody who seemed to be going on a more traditional Orthodox religious journey, seemed to evoke it quite a bit, especially during his second inaugural in his Gettysburg address, evoking the name of God and judgment upon the nation. But before he died, he never really had an official conversion to Orthodox Christianity, but it dominates his life such that he writes about Calvinism a lot. So he's a really interesting figure, and how does he fit in the Civil War period? And in particular, how did he influence American Presbyterianism? So, again, social factors. This is what's driving the fact I am now on slide number 12. Social factors that lead up to the Civil War kind of shape American Presbyterianism for the future. And there becomes, if you go back to your chart from last week, a divide between the Northern and the Southern Church. And this kind of does originate in the Civil War period. And you can argue that this eventually doesn't even get dealt with in the most productive way, and eventually leads up to the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Now, I've made an argument, historically speaking, that the EPC, if you go back and you study American Presbyterianism, is more aligned with what I would call the vision of the Northern Presbyterian Church, and I would say that the PCA is more aligned with the Southern vision of the church. I mean, hopefully we could perhaps join and have one big tent denomination in the future. But in the time being, I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. And the Civil War really did shape the landscape of American Presbyterianism. You could possibly argue up until this point, which I just said EPC and PCA are a little bit represent kind of two competing visions. So the big social event that happens during this time period, I'm now on slide 13, is what is called the Second Great Awakening. Now, during the Second Great Awakening, the Baptists and the Methodists dominate church growth. Calvinism really takes a back seat to Baptist and Methodism. Same with Episcopalians as well. And kind of been in decline in America ever since. But the Baptists and the Methodists take that, remember that free market thing I talked about last week, kind of to its logical end. And you start seeing the free market mentality and the Second Great Awakening really start to dominate American Christianity and Presbyterianism. And Presbyterians were like, well, how on earth do we react to people doing tent meetings? How do we, like you can see in this one, how do we react to people going around who are not ordained ministers preaching? Is this something that we can actually do, or is this something that we should not do? How you react to these questions will really tell me, as your pastor, if you are pro Second Great Awakening or you are not. So we have new innovations in this time period, which actually have been interesting because I'm married to somebody from Mexico. These kind of new innovations are transported to other parts of the world, but these are things such as tent meetings, which I know some of us had experience of as a kid. I've never personally had them, but we do have more sophisticated versions now where we have things such as, I think there's a youth event called Creation, which just got canceled because of the current crisis for this year. But that's kind of like a sophisticated tent meeting. We had things such as Sinner's Box, where you, you know, I always am asking us to invite people to church. But the way the Sinner's Box really worked, and I have to laugh about this, was you not only brought your friend to church, but you had a distinct pew where the pastor got to point at you and tell you how terrible of a person you were, called the Sinner's Box. And that was to get people to be nervous so that they could pray to receive Christ. And finally, the altar call gets invented during this time period and is a distinctly American practice that gets exported basically throughout the world. I'm not totally anti-altar call, but if you're doing it all the time, it really negates the purpose, and it ends up becoming kind of a liturgical thing for the Baptist and the Methodist. So these three things, which, I mean, you can still see them in American Presbyterianism or in American religion in general, they start during this specific time period. So the revival that happened, named the Second Great Awakening, gained the most momentum in the southern part of the United States. And this is why, when you go to the South, my fellow colleagues in the EPC, they will joke sometimes that they pastor an EPC church, but in reality they pastor a Baptist church. And this really goes all the way back to the Second Great Awakening, because it's had such a huge influence on the way religion was lived out. So even you get EPC churches in the South that still have to battle against this because their social state is such that the Second Great Awakening shaped them more than the First Great Awakening. And I would argue First Great Awakening, as we learned last week, has more of an influence on Western PA. You don't really get too many people doing tent meetings and Sinner's Boxes and altar calls in Pittsburgh. And at least that was not my experience as a kid growing up. So church growth really picks up during this time. I'm on slide number 14. You can kind of see the preacher preaching to people on the woods. This would have been like a tent meeting that Methodists would have put on. So you can drive around and you can see the pockets of the Great Awakening, New England, or the Second Great Awakening, Virginia, for example. I'd see when I would drive back from Liberty University to come back to Pennsylvania, and I would be taking these back roads. Again, you would see the landscape of how this is lived out in America if you take back roads. It doesn't really help to take the highways, but I had to take back roads to get to Liberty. And I would see signs for revivals, especially around May, because come June, it seems like revival was kind of like a big thing to go through. And my question is, has revivalism ever left the United States? And I would say probably not. We still have a huge revivalism streak in us. I know at Liberty University, where I went, for example, since Second Great Awakening happened in Virginia, that's where Liberty is. And a lot of these tent meetings and stuff, they still happen. They just were a little bit different. But at Liberty every semester, we had this thing called Spiritual Emphasis Week, which really was a time period for a week where you set aside to basically have a sophisticated modern tent meeting. And they would bring in a preacher from out of town who would really kind of sometimes be hellfire and brimstone, but their whole the whole thing was to get the school, I almost said church, get the school fired up about their faith and get ready for the rest of the semester, basically, and get people to serve, which was a really good thing. I mean, I went to Spiritual Emphasis this week and it had a deep impact on me. I shared a story, I think in the fall, about a time where we were told to give money for the price of jeans that we had, and that made a profound impact on me. But that kind of revivalism streak was still in me, and you can see it again through our current crisis with people kind of bringing up being missional. And I think I mentioned with the Kronos group that I was a little bit perplexed because as a small church of about 32 members, I think we have, our way of being missional was staying inside, loving our neighbor and praying for our neighbor. And if we have to get groceries for them, great. But at the same time, we don't want to put ourselves in harm's way. But if you have so we're more of a churchly group, I would say, and I would say that confidently as your pastor for a while. But if you have a more revivalism streak and you see this current crisis as a means to capitalize on doing outreach, which again, I'm not wholeheartedly against, but that free market mentality sometimes, not letting a crisis go to waste can at times make me feel kind of uncomfortable, taking revivalism too far. So to speak. So that church growth mentality, I think, really starts and picks up in the Second Great Awakening, and really demonstrates the disestablishment of religion. I think a lot of Presbyterian churches lost a lot of people to the Methodists and the Baptists because they kind of had the new and coolest techniques for how to do outreach to people. And I know Tom and Susan's Sunday school lesson a couple months ago, we played some revival tunes and screaming and shouting, and that kind of makes me think of this painting on slide number 14. So an interesting figure that I wanted to focus on a little bit this morning is Stonewall Jackson. Now, I don't know if you know this, but Stonewall Jackson on slide number 15, that's where I am right now, was a devout Presbyterian, kind of the old school type. Kind of borderline what I would call hyper-Calvinistic, really had a strong emphasis on the providence of God, and that made him kind of fearless on the battlefield. But let me read this quote to you that I tracked down, and it kind of gives you the description of Stonewall Jackson's personal faith. So he states, "Captain, my religious belief teaches me to feel as safe in battle as in the bed. God has fixed the time for my death. I do not concern myself about that, but to be that always ready, no matter when it may overtake me. Captain, that is the way all men should live, and then all would be equally brave." So that's a quite stunning quote from Stonewall Jackson, and kind of reveals the inward dynamic of his Christian faith, that he was not scared to die, and he actually did have his life taken on the battlefield. But he was somebody who really strongly believed in the providence of God, and kind of his extreme reformed understanding. I don't know if that was the wisest thing to do as a captain and as somebody who was involved in armed conflict. But nonetheless, it shows that he really did trust and believe that the Lord was sovereign over every sphere of life. So now I'm on the slide 16. And continue with Stonewall Jackson. You can see a painting there of him reading his Bible with his horse. Now, what's interesting about Stonewall Jackson is we actually do have a biography that was written about him by a Southern Presbyterian who's kind of like, up until recently, Robert Dabney was his name, was probably the, I don't know what you would call it, patron saint of the Presbyterian Church in America. But Robert Dabney also wasn't just a theologian at Columbia Theological Seminary, which was in Georgia, and then went eventually to the University of Texas, I believe. But he's also Stonewall Jackson's personal chaplain. So he traveled with Jackson during the Civil War, and he, that quote that we just got was because Robert Dabney knew him and wrote it down. But again, he was famous for engaging in battle because he was a hyper-Calvinist. He got involved in battle, was not scared about all the bullets flying around his head. He trusted in the Lord, and he actually was killed on the battlefield because he was actively engaged. But because of his strong understanding of the providence of God, he was not scared. So he kind of seems like a lunatic in our time period, but at the time, this is somebody who was really devout in their faith. Jackson and Robert E. Lee, kind of the general of the Southern Army, if memory serves me correctly, were actually close friends, and they prayed and read the Bible with each other on a regular basis. There's a film about the Civil War, and it shows, I remember Robert Duvall playing General Lee, but there's a scene where they're talking about their faith with one another and exchanging letters and how they pray for one another. Robert E. Lee was an Episcopalian, but of the more Calvinistic type. But it just shows that these two people had a deep Christian faith, even though we would probably judge them as paradoxical figures because they lost the war and they were pro-slavery. That's a hard one to swallow, but we want to be as generous and charitable to people such as Jackson and Robert E. Lee. But he was somebody who had a deep and profound faith, Christian faith. Okay, now I'm on slide number 17. This week I think we're getting through things a little bit quickly. But again, since I can't ask questions and get answer questions from you guys, you'll just have to email them to me offline. So now I am on slide number 17. So Stonewall Jackson's interesting because he's a paradoxical figure. So he fights for the South, but he started Sunday schools for the slaves. I was always interested in that. He's actually originally from West Virginia. I think if you drive down 79, right, maybe like 45 minutes north of Beckley, West Virginia, there's a town where he came from, and it's named after him, and I've been there. And every time I drive past there, I always think of Stonewall Jackson as kind of this really, really interesting figure to myself personally, because he's somebody that had came from the strong Reformed tradition, but at the same time was somebody that did outreach to slaves and started Sunday schools for them, which at that time, Sunday school was very innovative and new, and he did this. So he's somebody that is a paradox, so to speak. So I think we need to be careful when we study figures such as Stonewall Jackson and not to fall into what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery. And what I mean by that is if we started judging people in the past by the moral framework that we have now, maybe in today's society, we would start knocking off all kinds of different people from the Reformed tradition. I just read a few weeks ago, I was reading Ulrich Zwingli's biography, and he's somebody that I have a love-hate relationship with, but I found quite a lot of value in what I read about him. But we'll just take somebody like Zwingli, for example. He's somebody who had issues with prostitutes before he really came to saving faith. And because he's that paradoxical figure too, and if we are honest, all of our heroes are paradoxical figures. Nobody is perfect, not even the Apostle Paul, like we went over his conversion story last week. But we could really fall into chronological snobbery and judge people by our standards today, and then we would never read anybody in the past. And that's not what we want to do. We want to read people of the past and realize that even the saints are flawed. So Apostle Paul is an example. So if you ever get a chance, Dabney wrote a biography on Stonewall Jackson. You can read it. It's quite interesting. So now I am on slide 18. And in 18, we get to what I would call a transitional figure. And this is Billy Sunday. So Billy Sunday is a perfect test case for the free markets and the disestablishment that I talked about in week one. He's somebody that lived from 1862 to 1935, and the whole reason why Billy Sunday became an evangelist and became so famous was because he was a professional baseball player. He had no qualifications for preaching. He had no qualifications for expounding the Word of God well, other than the fact that he was somebody famous who could go around and rile up a crowd and who could put them on the path to moral moral transformation. He's somebody who probably, if you read the primary sources, his sources, would come across what we talked about last week as more of a moralist than somebody that's truly preaching the gospel. So what's really interesting about Billy Sunday in particular is the fact that he was a big player in the 18th Amendment to prohibit alcohol. And we can know that he is a moralist because he participated in that amendment. Now, I know social factors at that time were important and why people pushed for it, but it's interesting that he became kind of a big player. And we have celebrity preachers like this now who are not from the means. We're Presbyterians, so I had to be ordained. I had to go to school. I had to jump through a lot of hoops to get my ordination. And it took time. I mean, I wasn't ordained formally until I was 31 years old. It takes a while. But it kind of makes somebody like myself a little bit frustrated that somebody who was just famous because they're a baseball player got to go around the United States and barnstorm and preach. So what's so interesting is now I'm on slide 19. You can see Billy Sunday. He was known for his gimmicks and theatrics. And Billy Sunday kind of haunts American Presbyterianism and American evangelicalism. Because kind of, again, what you think about Billy Sunday will kind of show me where you fall on the spectrum of soul winner or churchly type of person. So he was a very controversial figure in the Presbyterian tradition because, again, we know that there's a lot of rules for being ordained, but he got to skip through all the hoops and got to be ordained in order to reach out to people. And you can kind of see him in this picture. I looked for pictures that were a little bit silly of him just because, just to kind of prove a point. His preaching, again, was known for being really over the top. He kicked over chairs and used eccentric gimmicks to build crowds. Again, this kind of has precedent as it goes back to the Second Great Awakening and the First Great Awakening even too. George Whitefield had some gimmicks that he used to use and used to be able to cry and do all these eccentric things. So there's not without precedent for Billy Sunday. But again, he continues in this tradition that goes all the way back to that. And that's where we'll conclude. Next week, we'll go over a really interesting time period, which will be modernism versus fundamentalism and kind of the prohibition. And as you can possibly pull up slide 20, you have a picture of a lady in glasses with a hatchet in one hand and a Bible in the other. I mean, she's quite scary. So thank you for your time, and I hope you learned a little bit this morning about American Presbyterianism.